College Football Podcast with Herbie and Pollock. Now here's your host, Kevin Nagandi.
The third playoff rankings are out, and a week after every team moved, we had no movement in the top seven, but no one expects it to stay that way moving forward. Coming up on the College Football Podcast with Herbie and Pollock, Heather Dinich going to join us, as she usually does on Wednesdays, with her first thoughts on the rankings and what it means for two conferences on the outside trying to get in. Also, Ivan Mazel on Nick Saban's reaction to losing Tua and what's the future look like for the star quarterback after hip surgery. Pollock's going to join us on Friday's podcast. Today, it's my pleasure to have another game day guy with us, the glue that holds it together on Saturday mornings, as well as Tuesday nights as he hosts the playoff rankings. It's great to have Reese Davis join us here on the podcast. RD, while I was sitting here thinking about some questions they ask you and setting things up, I was looking back and I was like, his first name's William. Where did Reese come from? And I didn't even have an answer. I've known you for 13 years. Where does Reese come from in your name?
It's part of my middle name. I've always been known as Reese. That's what my parents called me from the time I was a baby. My full name is William Laurice Davis. I was named after my grandfather. And, so it's not uncommon. You northern folk have a very difficult time with this because my my son also goes by his middle name. My wife, she has since dropped her first name, but she, you know, to make it simpler, but she went by her middle name growing up and still does. And it's just not that unusual in the South. But Laurice is my middle name, and Reese is what I've always gone by. So there you have it.
Us northern
folk
go with. Tom
Rinaldi just noticed that too. I have a bag that has the monogram on it. I usually just monogram things, RD, because that's what I am. But someone else had monogrammed this bag for me, and Tom goes, "What does the WLD stand for?" So he just found it out too. So now you're right on track with Rinaldi.
Oh yeah. Let's see if I can make somebody cry later on today on SportsCenter. Look forward to that. And us Northerners, we go with, if we hear the middle name ever uttered by our parents, that means, oh no, we're in trouble. And what do we do today? We're backtracking in like our last 3 to 4 hours because, no doubt we're going to go in timeout. At least that's in my house when my wife says the middle name and somebody, and she's a Southerner, but when she says the middle name of one of our kids, I know that somebody's in big trouble. And then
I can tell you this, as a Southerner, Kevin, timeout was something that was called at a sporting event. There were more severe consequences in my house if it got to that.
And listen,
yeah, Bear Bryant might have a timeout left. I don't know, but that's not what your problem is right now.
So. That's an excellent point, but maybe that works in the 70s as it did in my house. Exactly. It doesn't work in the 2019 era. So, and let's go back to the 90s here real quick, because you started at ESPN2 with the sports smash, and people don't understand what that was in the 90s. Like,
nor did I.
If that was your chance and your opportunity to come to Bristol, what exactly were you doing on Sports Smash?
That's a great question, because we didn't know. It was me, Kenny Mayne, and Deb Kaufman at the time. Bill Pito had been part of the Sports Smash too, but he had just gone to NHL Tonight. And this was in the era of the old Sports Night show that Stuart and Susie hosted together. And I was in there to provide updates at the top and the bottom of the hour, occasionally do other moments of hijinks or interviews, or go out to do, you know, pieces and stuff. And it was when they had decided that if we were going to wear a tie, don't wear a jacket. And if you're going to wear a jacket, don't wear a tie. And denim was preferred above all things. So, you know, it was, they had the grunge looking graphics and the whole thing. So the Sports Smash was basically top and the bottom of the hour updates. And the coolest thing for me at the time to get just a little bit of time to do something was if some, you know, bit of programming, the Jim Rome show or whatever it was called. I can't remember what it was called right now on ESPN2. I don't think it was called that. But if he came up a little short and you got to do 5 minutes instead of two, then that was a win.
So you're synonymous with college football and college basketball and game day. I think there's a generation that only knows you covering those sports. But, you know, your early years here where everybody that's an anchor that comes to the ESPN, you gotta be versatile. You gotta wear many hats before you can do the big ones. And you're doing RPM tonight. You're doing some horse racing. What did you ultimately want to do when you came to the Worldwide Leader before you had to do a bunch of other things?
College football and college basketball. Now, everybody that comes to ESPN at some point wants to do SportsCenter. And, after a while, I had a chance to do that. But ultimately, my goal has always been to have, to have a prominent role. It wasn't necessarily, even though I think I have the best job in television right now, with all due respect to yours, which is a very good job, too. But I didn't necessarily aspire to do College Game Day. One, you know, Chris was doing it. And two, I just, you know, I loved my role in the studio, which you know how much fun that is.
Yep.
And I wanted to do some games, and I wanted as prominent a role in the sport as I could, because that's the sport that I love the most. College basketball is right there with it. But those are the two things that I grew up with. And that's ultimately what I hoped my career would lead to. And I've been blessed and fortunate enough and worked with great people, and it has. The RPM thing was a little bit different. Norby Williamson, one of our executives, I distinctly remember talking to him. I think I was traveling to see my parents, but I called him from an airport. I had a message I needed to call him, and he wanted me to do RPM tonight. And I said to him, hey, Norby, because I was doing NBA tonight at the time, and I loved that. That I worked with Fred Carter, who as a Philly guy, I'm sure you know well, and Fred's a great guy, the Mad Dog. And so I was having a blast doing NBA tonight. And he said, hey, we thought I think Kenny was moving on to maybe SportsCenter or something, and do RPM tonight. And I said to him, hey, Norby, if you think, hey, let's get the Southern guy to do the car racing show, you've got the wrong dude. I said, I've been to one race in my life, and it was when I was working in television. It's just not, I said, I'll learn it and I'll give it its proper due and respect, but it's not really my thing. And he's like, no, we know you can learn it, and so forth. So I did. And it was, it was something that I enjoyed. I'm not going to lie, I never developed a real passion for that sport, but I did have a passion for doing the show well. And I think we did that, and we had a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's the key. If you know TV, you can find a way. I don't want to say to fool anybody, but to find a way to respect the sport, but also put together a good show, right?
Hey, man, if not for RPM tonight, I never would have spent a night in Mechanicsville, Pennsylvania, watching the World of Outlaws. And I used to start every show because, I was a wrestling fan. I love Ric Flair. And the World of Outlaws, we had a producer named Benji Cage, who, whenever the World of Outlaws, the sprint car races, would be in the rundown, he would abbreviate it as WOO. Well, that's woo, and that's Ric Flair to me. So before the show started, every time I would have the whole crew, and we would all yell, woo, to start. And then I would usually do that over the highlight, too, at some point. So now we had fun back in the early, middle age days of ESPN. We were getting things cranked up in the 90s, so it was fun.
I've heard many of the stories, in the 90s. I'm glad I came when I came, because I still got a little piece of it in 2006. Yeah. But I heard many of the stories in the 90s and how you guys had a lot of fun. And of course, launching a new network in the unknown to now where you are the face of college football on ESPN, considering you host the show, I think the best pregame show in all of American sports television. We're going to get to that experience and the game day experience and what it's been like for you. But before we get into that, I do want to get your thoughts on what the committee did last night. What did you learn from their rankings and how they see things after 3 weeks?
I don't mean this disrespectfully of the committee, but I don't know that we learned much, because I think it's a little bit of a fool's errand to be trying to say, oh, they did this, so they're going to do this in 2 weeks. Because the one thing that, and look, Kevin, I try to be a reasonable man, and maybe I'm misguided on this, but I get frustrated sometimes when people look at the rankings and say, well, they applied this measure here, but not this measure there. Well, it's because it's an art, and maybe what the chair people over the years have been trying to tell us is this is the difference maker. It didn't come into play in the discussion, a common opponent or a head-to-head result or whatever it may be, it didn't come into the discussion. So we keep acting like, or say we, a collective we, I think too many of us who love and watch this for some reason, are having a hard time breaking away from the old BCS formula or the polls and the math giving us the answer, you know, that there is an absolute answer. The reason we went to the committee was to allow some art and some judgment and football expertise and coaches in the room understanding situations of when games were played. So, I don't know that I can look at these rankings and say that, you know, oh, just because, Penn State moved ahead of Minnesota despite the head-to-head win, you know, that they don't respect Minnesota. You know, I don't think you can jump to that just yet, because first of all, it's such a small body. It's 13 people. And if you have in the old days of the polls, you have 65 voters or whatever it was, number of coaches, and I guess maybe a few more than that in the AP, and I should know that I vote in the AP, but it takes several people to change their minds to move the needle. I remember Brad Edwards used to do that in the old BCS formula era. This number of voters need to change in order for this to impact the BCS formula. When you have 13 people and voting the way they do, and I know you've been through the exercise where they have groups of six teams and three emerge from that, they are ranked, then three more are added to a group for another group of six and so on. It doesn't take as many people to change their minds to alter the outcome. And I think that's what people miss sometimes. And I try to say it, and look, you know, maybe some committee members someday, and I've talked to several of them over the years, not many of them over the years. And I think I'm on target here. It just doesn't take as many people to change their minds about something. And somebody could be sitting right on the fence. You got to cast a vote one way or the other. And, you know, it might not take much for them to have the teams in a different order the following week. And so I think sometimes when we start trying to look at what happened this week and apply it definitively, no matter what, to the next couple of weeks, I think it's sort of an exercise in folly.
Yeah. And one of those things is the head to head. I think it's the one thing that I think fans at home can say, well, I can guarantee one thing, because I have no idea what the committee's thinking. The guarantee is Minnesota should be ahead of Penn State because they won the head-to-head. What do you think about that process and the argument that, hey, look also common opponent and how Penn State handled some of the common opponents that Minnesota handled? This whole process also feels like a setup down the road when we potentially look at Oregon and Alabama versus Auburn.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. But I look at this and I think that's what I'm talking about, because I think that's going to be proven wrong. The thing is, there are a lot of people out there that don't follow Alabama or don't like Alabama or tired of Alabama winning. You think they get the benefit of the doubt, when the fact of the matter was, in 2017, they were clearly one of the four best teams in the country. That is not the case this year. Unequivocally, they're good and they can beat anyone, I think, or certainly they could before the Tua injury. I don't think that's the case this year. I called them, I think when you and I talked on SportsCenter, I called them a placeholder. I know I did it on the selection show, and that's what I believe. Absent it being a two-loss champion from the Pac-12 and a two-loss champion from the Big 12 and no, you know, double teams from the SEC or Big 10, I don't see them moving up. And I think everybody is fixated. Well, if they beat Auburn, Oregon didn't beat Auburn. I don't believe that's going to be the case, because they're going to be able to look at that and say, this is a different Oregon team. You factor in the conference championship. Is there really that big a difference between the two? Now, maybe I'll be proven wrong. And if I am, well, so be it. It's because I can't get inside the minds of 13 people. But I don't believe that they're setting the stage to be able to choose Alabama over Oregon in the event that Alabama beats Auburn. And in the event, by the way, that Oregon can stay undefeated in Pac-12 play and beat Utah in the championship game.
Yeah, you had mentioned the Alabama placeholder situation and being at five here. Is there any chance, you know, obviously if they're rooting for some chaos at the top, but is there any chance in your mind with Mac Jones as the quarterback where they can make a jump here into the top four? Let's just say if LSU handles their business against Georgia, and then we have a one-loss scenario in the Pac-12, and Utah or Oregon handle their business?
I would be surprised. I mean, I'm not going to say definitively because I'm not in the room. I believe, and maybe I will be wrong, but I believe that a one-loss Pac-12 champion will go in ahead of Alabama. That's what I believe. I think Alabama can still make the playoff. But what they need to happen is for the top three to be undefeated, for Oregon or Utah to stumble along the way, and then the one who stumbled wins the Pac-12 championship, or Utah stumbles and SC wins the Pac-12, you know, something like that, and for the Big 12 to continue to beat itself up and the winner emerge with two losses.
Yeah, I was about to say, Oklahoma's raising their hand, right?
Yeah, if Baylor is the Pac-12, I mean, pardon me, if Baylor is the Big 12, if Baylor's the Pac-12 champion, you got a story. If Baylor is the Big 12 champion with one loss, then I might see Alabama finishing ahead of them in the event that Alabama beats Auburn, which is certainly no guarantee given an inexperienced quarterback against that Auburn defensive front.
Do you like the current format of the playoff? Is four teams too many or just enough? Or too little?
I think it's just enough for right now, Kevin. There will come a day when it's going to expand. I mean, I think everybody knows that because there will be an outcry and a demand for it just as there was for four. But I find something compelling and intriguing about a playoff system that it is hard to get into. In the event we're talking about Alabama a lot, but in the event that Alabama doesn't make it with one loss by 5 points to the number one team, you know, I mean, I know that you have the extenuating circumstance of the Tua injury and their schedule hasn't fallen for them the way they anticipated, in terms of having difficult opponents, which they typically do both in conference and non-conference, but you're still talking about an 11-1 team that lost to number one by five, you know, and they didn't make it if that's the case, or if they did make it, you would be talking about, you know, a one loss Baylor or potentially a one loss Oklahoma, or even if it falls this way and let's say Oregon or Utah make it and Oklahoma doesn't, Oklahoma goes through, they have one loss and they don't make it. You know, there's something intriguing and compelling to me about it being hard to get in. And, there's going to come a day when we need to expand to eight. But when we do, we need to overhaul the system completely. And by that, I mean, you can't put all this premium on conference championships decided by conference championship games if somehow, to use last year as an example, that somehow Northwestern and Pittsburgh are in the mix. That's no good. We don't need that. You know, so you've got to either do away with them and play the first round and find a way to replace that money, or you just have to do away with the divisions. The divisions were a good idea when they started, but, you know, right now people they fall into this pro mentality and put this outsized importance on a conference championship game that last year pitted Clemson and Pittsburgh, right? Pittsburgh? Yep. Why is Pittsburgh in the mix if that game is so important? The answer is the divisions aren't equal. They never will be. And there's a greater disparity at times, and it's cyclical, but there's greater disparity in the divisions than what you see in professional sports. And, you know, right now the ACC Coastal is a mess, and the Big Ten West, while improving, is not great. And, you know, the SEC East is a little shaky. It's got a couple of good teams. That's it. And even a couple teams in the West are down, but these things are cyclical and they change, but we can't place this outsized importance on a conference championship game when you have the winner of the ACC Coastal with, you know, four losses or whatever in the mix. That's no good. You know, so when we expand, we've got to take care of all of it. And I don't know how many years down the road that's going to be, but it needs to be overhauled and fixed. And, you know, my suggestion is I'd like to see the SEC and the ACC both play 10 conference games, Pac-12 and Big Ten do the same, 10, not 9, 10. Play another Power 5 opponent and the other one, and then do whatever you want for the rest. I think the Big 12 can probably come up with enough games playing their round robin, playing a couple of other Power 5s, and everybody would end up playing 11 Power 5s, and then whatever you want to do with that 12th game, have at it. You know, if you want to, you know, give an FCS $500,000 to come in, go for it. If you want to play a group of five, go for it. But that's what I would like to see eventually when we expand. And if and when they follow my plan after I'm named czar of college football and, you know, and they do away with the divisions and decide the conferences in a different manner.
You'll head that up. Then we'll have Billis run, you know, the college basketball scene, and then all will be well, right? Everything will be perfect going forward.
Yeah, I'll digress for a minute. My wife and I were watching the class at Safe Coach K last night. And Billis is probably going to hate this because, I mean, Jay and I are great friends and really close. And my wife was watching and she goes, wow. She goes, I see a different side of Jay that I've never seen last night. Just the, you know, I think the emotion and, you know, the closeness that they felt with that class, plus the pain of that championship game. And I joke with it because I joke with Jay about everything. And that's sort of our, it's everybody's friendship with Jay. He busts chops and that's off limits, you know, to me, because I know what that class meant to him and what that game meant to all of those guys. I thought, you know, I don't mean to be doing a plug for the films, but that class that saved Coach K, to see Allery and, you know, and Johnny Dawkins and all those guys come together and talk about that was really cool. But anyway, to football.
No, I love that you brought that up, because I caught a snippet of it. I caught the section where they were talking about how MJ was tearing them up. They had no answer for him. And you just see some of the footage and you're like, oh my God, I can't imagine Michael Jordan on, if there was social media back then, how crazy it would have been, just because he separated himself from everybody on that old footage back at Carolina.
Allery told the story that I'd heard him tell before about watching him when they were going to, I think, play pickup in the summer, if I recall the story correctly. He hit his head on the backboard and they're like, What is happening here?
It's good stuff. And it was also interesting to watch some of the footage where you're looking at, you know, where Duke is playing at the time. And you're like, oh my goodness, there's no Cameron Crazies. Look at the space on the floor. No one's around these games. It's very surreal to see it back then. There is one interesting topic that I think, and I actually admire how you handle it. You went to Alabama. You're passionate about college football. How do you separate yourself? I know how I do it, being an Eagles fan and obviously loving my school at Temple and anything Philadelphia. I find a way where I'm actually more critical of the teams that I follow, because I follow them so much. How do you separate yourself from, you know, Alabama, being an alum, growing up on the sport, and now covering the sport?
I think the first thing is that it's not as hard as people think it is. And part of that reason is, you know, and I'm not trying to be snarky or deflective or anything, part of it is that your job and your paycheck depends on it. You need to do the right thing. And the other thing is that I've really found that I think has changed things just over the years. Even when I was working in local television, you start covering the people and the teams, and you start to realize that the rival school or the rival team is not just a collection of robots in opposing colors. They're people, you know, and they're working, and you kind of gain access to their programs and you see what they go through. Probably the quintessential story of this, and I think I'd gotten it well under control by then. But I had a lot of friends after the Deshaun Watson year in which he threw a touchdown pass, Hunter Renfrow, and they beat Alabama on the last play. I had a lot of my friends from school saying, man, that must have been rough, handing that trophy to Dabo. And I said, no, it really wasn't. And the reason for it was because I had been back by the locker room, walking back to the office area the previous year. And I saw Dabo's wife, Kathleen, who's a wonderful woman, and his sons, who, you know, are playing there now, a couple of them are, and they were devastated. You know, the disappointment was, you know, was so raw. And it's not that you don't care about your alma mater anymore. It's just that it's fairly easy to gain perspective when you've been able to see what others have put into it as well, and you have respect for them, and you have respect for the show and the process. Because while I grew up loving Alabama, and I still do, people don't care about that. I didn't play there. It's different for Kirk and Desmond and David, you know, guys who had careers there. People do care, you know, about what they think about or where they went to school. People don't care where I went to school, you know, so I don't need to make that a thing. And so I try to be as fair as I can. I think at times in my career, I've probably been too hard on them, and an effort, as you well know from your love of the Eagles, sometimes you can be too hard on them in an effort to be fair. But I hope that I found a pretty good balance in that regard right now. But I don't think that we're called on, as people who cover the sport, to be emotionless robots and say, I do not care who wins games. You know, you're, but the thing is that we're called on to view this entire thing through a prism of fairness. There's no such thing as being unbiased. Everybody has a bias towards something. And I don't mean, you know, toward a team or a conference, but maybe you prefer the spread, or maybe you prefer offensive football, or you love coaches who go for it on fourth downs, you know, whatever. So you predispose to thinking that's the right way to do it. But what you're called on to do is to be fair. And hopefully we do that, because, you know, you know these guys, and I always say I'm not friends with any coach, but I'm friendly with a lot of them. So I've got a lot of respect for what they do, and the players who are, you know, the ages of my kids, you know, so I understand and have a good idea of what they're going through in their life and what they're putting into their sport. And so, you know, you never want to diminish that by, you know, standing out there and, you know, being overly happy if your alma mater wins, or overly sad if they lose. You have to do the right thing and be fair.
I appreciate you explaining all that, because I think people do get it twisted. And it was a great example of, you knowing Dabo in the sense that you've seen him care genuinely. And in the end, it is a people relationship business. And if you see somebody that you think that genuinely cares, that pours their heart into it, and it doesn't really matter what laundry they're wearing or what hat they have on their head, you respect what they're doing. And that's kind of our job, to cover the stories and discuss, you know, what they're doing. And if they're doing it at an excellent level, then they deserve to be covered the right way. And you're right. I think you nailed that perfectly. And I bring that up to you because I've never seen you become partial to, you know, your alma mater. I bring that up because I think there is a fan base that sometimes, not specifically to you, but just sometimes at home, thinks that, oh, they're rooting for somebody. No, we're not really rooting for somebody. rooting for stories. That's what we love. We love stories.
You end up rooting for the story. You know, it was driven home to me pretty early in my career when I was working in Columbus, Georgia. Columbus, Georgia, which is my wife's hometown, is about 30 minutes from Auburn. So right after I graduated from school at Alabama, I went to work there. And so I spent a whole lot of time at Pat Dye press conferences. And my first year there, one of my high school football and basketball teammates, a guy that that I had roomed with at basketball camps and stuff like that, and been teammates with him in football, you know, growing up, and was through high school. He was a standout all conference safety for Auburn, a guy named Carlo Cheatham, who was a tremendous athlete. And I remember, you know, going over there for media availabilities, and I'm interviewing a guy I roomed with, you know, at basketball camps and stuff. And that's when it kind of hit me, or I even remember thinking that, you know, these guys aren't just people who wear orange and blue helmets. You know, that's somebody that I've competed with, you know, and that we've tried to win together with, and that we were friends in high school. And now, you know, it's not as hard as people think, I guess, maybe is the best way to put it. I think I understand why they do, because the fans' only calling is to view what we say and what we think about situations through the prism of how it affects how I feel about my team and whether that lines up. And if it doesn't, well, then they get mad, and that's fine, because that's what makes people passionate about the sport and makes people want to watch our show and watch you guys throughout the day on Saturday.
Yeah. And I always tell people too that, we got into the business because we love sport the way you love sport. You know, that we're passionate fans in the beginning, and then over time it just changes and develops because we go into a position where we're wearing a completely different hat. And, you know, I will share real quickly with, you know, the whole entire Eagles Super Bowl run in 2017. I started noticing that, you know, it was the 15-year-old in me that was rooting because of the experience with my father, not so much you know, the guy that was in his 40s that was celebrating this. It was like, I can't believe this is happening for the 15-year-old, and I can't wait to share this with my dad. And then having, you know, two young sons, I can't wait to talk to them about it. And that's the reason why we fall in love with sport, right? I know you had a relationship with your father and Bama football. We fall in love with these ties that we have, and they connect us with, you know, our fondest memories as kids growing up. And I think there's a generation that wakes up for me that's carried through in my house now with a 5-year-old and 7-year-old boys that love college football. Is Saturdays we pop on game day and we hear, you know, you with the introduction to setting up the environment for the rest of the day. And game day to me is the perfect setup. It, you cannot have a Saturday without game day. And we've had guys here with Herbie and Pollock and Felica on the show. I want to know what your schedule's like, because it is so unique from everybody else. What's your schedule like leading into game day? How about we'll start on a Friday getting prepared and then getting juiced up on a Saturday morning ready to do 3 hours of TV?
On Fridays, I'll spend virtually the entire day in the office. I like to get in there, you know, half hour, 45 minutes before the meeting to, you know, kind of get with our producer Jim Guerrero and Drew Gallagher, our CP, and, you know, kind of talk about our plan for the meeting and stuff like that, and make sure we're on the same page. Anything that we've decided we wanted to change or something like that through our, you know, weeks of preparation and various versions of the rundown usually go 8 to 10 deep by the time we get to Saturday morning. And then, you know, we'll have the meeting. We never go through the meeting and say, you say this and he says that. I want to know what everybody thinks. And we also don't want to do the show in the Friday meeting. So we kind of keep it to broad topics and discuss which topics about a certain game or storyline or player, or whatever, that we ought to discuss. How, you know, maybe a quick, do you feel strongly about this, or how do you feel about that? Or maybe, you know, one of us brings up a point and someone reacts to it and we go, there we go, we've got it. And so the meeting kind of goes like that. You know, you do the various SportsCenter and ABC hits and whatever might be needed. And then usually there's, you know, a media obligation. And then I go, you know, right back into the office and I sit beside Jim and we kind of hash through things. And I write, you know, we don't do a prompter or anything like that. As you guys know, I tend to write it out just to collect my thoughts. You know, here's the topic. I rarely ever get it verbatim, you know, as to what I've written. I don't try to memorize it. I just say, okay, we're talking about this. I'm leading to this, you know, this topic. What do I want to say about that? You know, and I do it that way. So I'll do that. Usually go back to the hotel, generally stay in on Friday nights, even for dinner. Occasionally I might pop out for something quick, depending on how far I am. And I try to, you know, I try to hit up some coaches and SIDs or different things. You know, what move are you seeing? What'd you tell the team? Anything happened on the trip? You know, that kind of stuff. So we can get some fresh stuff if it's applicable. Sometimes it is, sometimes it's not. And, you know, so that's Friday night. I usually will go to bed around, you know, midnight Eastern time, and then usually a 5:15 pickup. And I try to be in the office at 5:30 6:30 before, I'm on Central Time. We've had a lot of Central Time shows this year, but usually try to get in about 2.5 hours before, because that beats almost everybody in, because I like to have a little time when there's just a few of us in there before it kind of gets crazy and chaotic, which it really does in the last hour or so leading up to the show.
Love it. And the experience is fantastic for 3 hours as you prep for it. You've been a part of it, what, since 2015. Is there a show that stands out for you personally when you look back and you're like, man, that was – I'm not sure I'll be able to replicate that?
Washington State. I mean, I've said that if – I'm not just in it for the scene and the environment and the adrenaline rush, but if I were, I might as well have retired after that show because it was – I mean – they had the 15-year quest with the flag, a crusade to get the show to Pullman. And when we went, the reception was so overwhelming that it was, you know, it was just awesome. And just, you know, whether it's having the quirky coach who was there, they were in the mix, you know, they were fighting for championship, plus just the fact that they wanted to showcase their pride in their team and their program and their university. And it was amazing. I mean, there were people, Kevin, I went to the set, you know, Pacific time, obviously, you know, you get there at 3:45. There are people out there. There's loud music and people as far as you can see, and they're singing. And I'm sure they've been drinking, because I think the Coug only closed for 2 hours on Friday night and then opened back up or something. So
that's
they could
great.
Continue serving. And I mean, it was wild, man. I mean, it was just awesome. We had a blast and had some cool elements in the show. You know, everything gets spoiled if the show doesn't go home well, you know, or even if maybe people don't notice, but if there's something that you weren't pleased with, you know, it kind of ruins what in your own mind anyway, whatever else happened. But everything seemed to fall together that day, and the crowd was great, and the, you know, crowd, weather, atmosphere, storyline, you name it. And it was that I'm going to have a hard time in my career ever topping that day in that show in terms of the adrenaline and the energy that was on the set that day.
I just remember the opening shot. It's just pitch dark and you're like, man, they showed up. They've been waiting for this one for some decades. They're like, you know, obviously with the carrying of the flag and the old crimson, what an experience. For you, I hate the idea of people ever saying playing traffic cop, because that's not what you're doing. Your job is to obviously get the best out of everybody involved, but you're also dealing with different personalities, you know, from Herbie, Coach Corso, Dez, Pollock, the Bear. What's that like for you?
And I'm glad you said that, because I think that, you know, I get, you know, Guerrero always laughs because I hate it. If a producer says tee it up, you know, and in fact, so yep. Pollock says it all the time just to annoy me, you know, because, you know, he's a little brother I never wanted. I think that a good host is involved in the conversation, and you just have to feel it. Now, I'm never going to argue with Kirk about, you know, the proper technique for taking a drop for quarterback. I'm not going to argue with Pollock about hand placement for defensive lineman. But we can argue about, you know, which team is better, or whether something is significant, or whether a coach should have gone for it on fourth down. You know, why did he punt in the 38? You know, whatever it might be. And everybody, regardless of whether you played or just been, you know, whatever level you played at, just a fan of the sport, you can understand those things. And I think you have to be involved and informed in the conversation to do it best. And beyond that, it's just a feel. But I do think there is an element of making sure that everybody gets theirs, you know, that it's and knowing what guys' strong suits are, and knowing what they're passionate about, and knowing, you know, if you feel like you haven't heard enough from Desmond or whoever in the last discussion or two, making sure that you get something out of him or challenge him on something. And, you know, those types of things, I think, are more feel than anything other than that. It's not really anything you can plan out.
Before we wrap up, I got a couple more questions. The last one's going to be some advice to young broadcasters in the business, but you mentioned Pollock. Pollock's on this podcast with us on Wednesdays and Fridays, and you nailed it. He is the little brother that we wish we never had. and I'm giving you the opportunity because I was fascinated with Pollock's diet. I've seen it a couple times when we're at events together and you're just like, oh, what are you eating? Like, you're eating nothing. And he brought it up and he went into full detail about his diet, and I was pestering him about it. But he also mentioned how he got on you about you having a dad bod at a certain point and then how you slimmed down. And I'm giving you the opportunity now to answer back with those comments that Pollock made here on the podcast.
I can't say anything because it's true. He did get on me, but I know he likes to think that he's the reason that, that I got in better shape, but he's not. You know, he loves to guilt everybody in the office about what they're eating. It's really hilarious to watch people who aren't even on a diet look around to see if he's watching before they get a cookie. You know,
he's the worst.
It's not so much that they care what he thinks. It's just they don't want to deal with it, you know. It's not, and yep. he has the best of intentions. And as David and I are really tight. And, you know, I think the world of him. But he was on me. He was like, dude, come on. You know, you better shape this. I'm like, I don't really care. But the weight that I lost, and you've gotten in great shape too, but part of mine was all, I don't want to say accidental, but it was just, I didn't really intend to do what I've done, but I'm maintaining it. I'm enjoying it. And I like having Pollock not bother me when I eat now. So that's really good.
Well, you gotta make sure you got thick skin and also a smart diet around those guys. Let me tell you, because you're going to hear it. And before we let you go, because I know we have a lot of people that come to me through the years. I think anybody that works at ESPN, that when you're in the business, we have young aspiring broadcasters that are in college or in their 20s, and they want to know how it worked for you. What was your biggest thing that got you through it all? What would be your best advice to a young broadcaster in their 20s?
I think to read a lot, whatever it is, because the more you read, the greater command that you have of the language to be able to express exactly what you mean. And I'm not talking about using big vocabulary words or anything like that. Just really knowing how you want to express yourself is really important if you want to be a broadcaster. The other thing that I think is important, Kevin, is that everybody looks to cut through. It's something that has been a mantra at ESPN and an understandable one in this age of extensive media and various platforms. But you're not going to cut through if you're a fake. So what the best way I've ever heard to describe it is that you need to be a slightly exaggerated version of yourself. Because if you were just yourself, people always say, be yourself. That's probably way too boring to be on television for almost everybody. But if you're an exaggerated version of yourself and accentuate things and really be in the moment when you're doing those, that's genuine. And that would be the best advice. Don't try to, you know, craft some character to be on or craft some persona that is you think is going to cut through. If you're passionate about what you do, if you love sports, if you prepare yourself, if you know how to communicate and you just exaggerate or maybe accentuate, an even better word, some aspects of your personality, that will work best. And that would be what I would say to it. And that's beyond the obvious of get experience. You want to be on TV, get on camera as soon as you can. But beyond that, that's what I would tell them.
You do an excellent job of sticking to a story, and then every now and then a subtle jab on the set, like, you know, on game day with Herbie and his comment about Bully with Mississippi State, and then you ride that through to commercial break. And then you did it last night with Jesse when Jesse had to tell everybody that he's a host who has an Emmy, and you bring up the Daily Mail. Like, they just those small little things are so good going to break where you're like, all right, we're going to get to the story, but I'll, you know, we'll talk about this Daily Mail Emmy. Don't throw it in my face. It's great TV. RD.
How about Palmer dropping that one last night?
Oh, that was great. Like he was ticked off about something, and he was like, I need to be heard right now in this segment, and I'm going to tell you that I used to be I'm a host too, and I can ask questions.
He's a beauty, man. That one is.
RD, you're the best. I appreciate the time here on the podcast, and enjoy game day this weekend. Going to be a great environment in Columbus, Ohio State, Penn State.
All right, Kevin. Thanks, buddy. Talk to you soon.
And we'll be back in just a moment with Heather Dinich and what sneaky lesson she learned from the latest college football playoff rankings. But first, a word from Allstate and AT&T.
Because mayhem on Saturdays in the fall is inevitable. Mayhem happens on the field, off the field, and in the polls. Mayhem lives on the wind, in the rain, on the foot of an errant kick, and during a trap game. You'll find mayhem in the parking lot, during tailgates, charcoal that's not totally out, an errant football through a window, a flat tire, a lost side view mirror, etc. You get the point. Allstate protects you from mayhem in the parking lot and outside it, at home and away. You can't stop mayhem from happening, but you can get better protected from it with Allstate. The potential for mayhem during the playoff race is rampant. underdogs, trap games, unexpected weather, etc., etc., etc. Get better protected from mayhem with Allstate. Contact your local Allstate agent today.
Yeah, college football is great unless, of course, it's just okay. Like when students decide to paint their chests with different letters to spell some word, and then they stand together to get on TV, but they're spelling the word wrong, or they lined up in the wrong order. Sure, not everybody's an English major, and I get it. We can't all win the national spelling bee. But come on, people. You should know how to spell Wildcats or Bulldogs. The purpose isn't to have a word jumble in the student section to keep your mind sharp or something. Just okay is not okay, whether it's college football fans or your wireless network. You want to watch the best college football just like you want to go with AT&T, America's best network. Don't settle for typos on people's chests, and don't settle for anything less than the best wireless network. Get the best college football and get AT&T. Best network based on GWS One Score, September 2019. Always great on a Wednesday after the rankings come out to have college football insider Heather Dinich joining us here on the College Football Podcast with Herbie and Pollock. Heather, you know, I mentioned this at the beginning of the podcast that a week ago, everybody in the top 25 moved. This week, the top seven stayed the same. Did you learn anything from the committee last night moving forward on heading into the weekend?
Absolutely. But it's sneaky. It's a sneaky lesson. USC popping in at number 23 is very important. And I say that because the Pac-12 is right there on the bubble in prime position to make a push in that conference championship game. And USC is an X factor in that whole conversation because one of the big reasons Oregon has been ranked ahead of Utah to this point is because it beat USC and Utah lost to USC. The crazy thing about it is that USC can still win the South. What? If that happens, if that happens because they have the tiebreaker over Utah, then we're having a different conversation. It also helps, obviously, Oregon's resume right now because that's another win against a ranked opponent. And it's the first time that we've seen the committee give anybody else in that conference credit besides Oregon or Utah.
And Utah in front of them. Listen, we've seen crazier things happen late in the season. They've got on the road at Arizona and then Colorado at home on the 30th. So a lot of things can play out here. And if a scenario plays out where Utah would lose before and Oregon plays USC, doesn't that favor a team like Alabama sitting there at 5 when you look at the value of wins and also who you've beaten quality?
Well, that's the thing, right? It opens that door a lot wider for an 11-1 Alabama team that can somehow find a way with Mac Jones in the lineup to just beat the snot out of Auburn in the Iron Bowl. And then we're having a different conversation.
Yeah, and the conversation last night, it felt like took a turn here when we looked at where Minnesota was and where Penn State was, especially head-to-head. And then it was discussed that who, like the common opponents and how they've beaten Penn State, how Penn State's beaten the same common opponents that Minnesota has beaten. How much does that play down the road here with the measurement of up against Auburn with Oregon and Alabama?
That's interesting because, for one, Minnesota's still a top 10 team in the eyes of the committee after that loss. That's important. The other thing is that they quickly ignored the head-to-head result, obviously, which probably has Minnesota fans a little bit upset. But they clearly really like Penn State, in part because they beat number 13 Michigan. They got the road win at Iowa. Their only loss is to the team ranked number 10 right now, Minnesota. And shockingly, they put a lot of stock into the win against Pitt, which is 7-3 right now. So they really like Penn State's resume. The question is, can the Nittany Lions muster enough offense to actually beat Ohio State and Columbus? If they can, then, and Penn State avenges that regular season loss to Minnesota in the Big Ten championship game, I would think the Nittany Lions are in.
Now, if Ohio State, they're favored by 18 points heading into this game, the return of Chase Young as well. If Ohio State wins by 20, 25 points, could you see then next week that Ohio State jumps LSU here as the one seed?
I could see that. Yes, that will be an interesting debate if that actually plays out. You know what? I think the spread is spot on this week. If you watch Penn State against Indiana last week with KJ Hamler out, one of their best receivers, you know, Sean Clifford's a good quarterback. I don't think he's great. They've got to run the ball better. Otherwise, they are going to get beat by 2 touchdowns. And if they do, then yeah, I think Ohio State has a really great shot to unseat LSU for that number one spot.
Now, also, it feels like, too, that I think people are coming to a quick assumption that, hey, you could just switch spots, 1 and 2, 1 and 2. But I really think the idea of getting that one seed is critical here. If you're the 2 seed, and let's just hypothetically say it's a battle between LSU and Ohio State, there's got to be some fear that you have to play Clemson, who's coming in as a 3 seed, right? Like, it feels like the next couple of weeks, Ohio State and LSU have to keep that in mind on style points down the road. And I know when I say style points, they don't take that into consideration, but that has to play a role here with the eye test.
Sure, that certainly matters. And the seeds do matter. And they also matter for location, too, because they won't put the number one seed at any type of geographic disadvantage. So all of that comes into play. And they, you know, it's interesting on the teleconference on Tuesday night with committee chair Rob Mullins, he was asked about scoring margin several different times from different people in different ways. And he continued to just repeat the party line that we don't incent margin of victory. But at the same time, it's clear that you are rewarded for dominant wins.
How do you view Oklahoma in the middle of all this?
Oh man, they need some help. You know, they really do. And it's not just because of the schedule. It's because they have been so inconsistent, not just within games, but from half to half. And when you go and beat an undefeated Baylor on the road, great win, absolutely. But Baylor was the 13th team in the eyes of the committee, and Baylor really not getting a lot of respect from them. Rob Mullins pointed out on Tuesday night that Baylor's non-conference wins have a combined, non-conference opponents have a combined 7 wins. So, you know, I think that big picture perspective, they're just not wowing the committee on the field or in the schedule.
Heather, anything else that you took away from last night or something that we should keep in mind heading into the weekend?
Well, I think that there are just so many things that can still happen. And while it was kind of ho-hum with 7 teams, you know, coming back in the same order at the top, there's 2 weeks left, and there really are a lot of different things that can play out. You can't eliminate Alabama entirely. Can't eliminate Oklahoma entirely, because if you get that upset in the Pac-12, or if there's a real shocker and somehow South Carolina beats Clemson, whatever it might be, it can open the door for some other, there's a pile of one loss teams, and they can all get back in the conversation very quickly.
It feels like, too, with all of these things and the battle for the 4th spot, the easiest situation for the committee would be, hypothetically, LSU wins all the way out up until Atlanta. Georgia handles their business. And then Georgia beats LSU. And then LSU drops to 4, right? And then Georgia bumps up to 3, Ohio State 1 and 2 with Clemson there, right? That would be the easiest scenario for the committee, right?
I would agree with that. Yep. But
okay.
Upset watch with Georgia against A&M this week. Then what?
Yep.
Then
yep. Exactly.
You know, I mean, we don't know. That's why college football is so fun. Nobody thought Georgia would lose to South Carolina either. So I'm just throwing it out there.
Yeah, and A&M seems to be back on track after, you know, some tough parts of their schedule. And I've got to give Georgia a ton of credit, too. I thought they have found a way to grind it out. And that's, I think, how Kirby likes his whole philosophy on offense. We will grind you out. You know, Alabama will have the explosive stuff. LSU will have the explosive stuff, but we are going to grind you out the rest of the way and play the old school SEC style. And it has worked ever since, you know, the South Carolina debacle. Heather, thank you so much. Honestly, I know on Wednesdays, right after the rankings come out on Tuesday night, that you are in high demand. So we do appreciate the 10 to 15 minutes you can share with us here on the podcast.
My pleasure. Thank you so very much.
It's Wednesday. That means we've got Ivan Maizel joining us. He's going to share his thoughts on Nick Saban's relationship with Tua Tagovailoa. Before we get to him, let's pause to hear from today's sponsors, Dr. Pepper and Goodyear. make sure to tune in to my new favorite TV show, Fansville, presented by Dr. Pepper, returning every Saturday throughout the college football season during the commercials. Fansville is the only show that stars Dr. Pepper, puts the spotlight on fans, and perfectly captures the emotional roller coaster that is the college football season. Critics are saying it's good. Fantastic. Is anyone else thirsty? And literally the best thing since Diet Dr. Pepper and Dr. Pepper Cherry. In Fansville, Dr. Pepper delivers a tour de force performance alongside legendary college football co-stars Brian the Boz Bosworth and Eddie George. Experience the pain, the passion, and the deliciousness of college football fandom this fall on Fansville, presented by Dr. Pepper. So pull over, veer right, slant left, do what you gotta do to get to your local store and pick up some refreshing ice cold Dr. Pepper, the official drink of Fansville. And hey, while you're at it, don't be afraid to go for two.
Sometimes for inspiration, you just have to look up. For more than 60 years, the Goodyear blimp has fueled greatness on the gridiron by providing aerial coverage of some of the most legendary moments in college football history. When the Goodyear blimp rises above a stadium, it inspires players to reach higher and rise to the challenge of the game's biggest moments. Now it's your turn to go further with Goodyear. Discover tires made to rise above the rest. Learn more at Goodyear.com. Goodyear, more driven.
Always good to have ESPN senior writer Ivan Maizel joining us here on the podcast each and every Wednesday. And Ivan, you know, the last few weeks we've talked to you where you were in Tuscaloosa a couple weeks ago, and last week you witnessed the game and the loss, Alabama losing to LSU. And I want to get your reaction because you've been around the program recently to the last few days, obviously losing Tua Tagovailoa, and you know, we'll talk about his future in a moment, but how about the reaction from Nick Saban, you know, at halftime with Molly, post game, where it looked like he was really shaken up, and then he had to come out and defend himself on the decision of Tua staying in the game or even starting that game and the thought process. What was your takeaway with Saban in the last few days after losing Tua Tagovailoa?
You know, Kevin, I was really taken with the emotion he showed more in the Monday press conference than I was, you know, at the halftime and in the post game. At halftime, he didn't really know what had happened. He knew it was not good. In the post game, he hadn't really had a chance to process it yet. But I think by the Monday afternoon press conference, you know, Tua had already been flown to Houston. He'd had the surgery. I don't know that Nick knew that the prognosis coming out of the surgery was excellent. I don't know if Nick knew it at that time, but clearly it had preyed on his mind. And the comments he made that he was calling Tua to cheer him up and that Tua was cheering him up. And, I think Mark Schlabaugh was there, and Mark relayed to me that Nick had said there are a handful of guys in a coaching career that you really have you feel a little differently about. And this is emotional territory that Nick does not enter into very often. And so I was just taken by his feelings for Tua and the fact that he expressed them publicly to a fan base that pretty much feels the same way about Tua that he does.
What is it about Tua? And you said, you know, how Nick feels about him, a fan base feels about him. What is it about Tua that separates him from other stars at Alabama?
Well, he's just a naturally ebullient personality. You know, he is a guy that even as a freshman would walk into the quarterback meetings playing a ukulele. You know, you don't get that a whole lot in a football building. He is a sunny presence, and he is a magnet. That somebody was telling me, I think when he was at the Elite 11, the number of kids that wanted just to get into his room to hang out with him, there was like a line outside his door. And this is when he was in high school. So, you know, he's a different cat. And, that, you know, we haven't even scratched the surface of his athletic ability, which has been enormous, in 2+ seasons at Alabama. And really, you know, he didn't play very much the first season. It's really been a season and a half. but he's had three at this point really unfortunate injuries.
I appreciate you sharing that story at the Elite 11, because he does have a personality where everybody's attracted to him. I spent some time with him a couple of days after losing the national championship, and we're at the Walter Camp Awards, and he has this wonderment, curiosity in every conversation where he is completely tuned in. He's focused on you, and you sit there and you're like, you don't have to be like that. You considering, you know, your credentials, and everybody wants a piece of you, but he has time for literally everybody he talks to, and he's engaged. And you felt that from the beginning. And I've seen, you know, and that wasn't just with me, just his interaction with literally everybody around him that night. I was really impressed by that, where we're talking about a young man who is a superstar in every single conversation or wherever he goes. Especially in Tuscaloosa. And moving forward here, this hip surgery and the rehab, they say 3 months, that coincides right around the combine here. What do you think, yes, moving forward? You know, he's going to be picked and prodded nonstop on our network, because we're doing our job because it's a conversation.
That's what we
did. Exactly. But I think every sports entity that's covering the Tua Tagovailoa scenario entering the NFL draft, what do you think is going to be his biggest challenge?
Well, I think it will be the decision. How much progress has he shown by the deadline to enter the draft? And what are the monetary stakes for him? Does he risk coming out before he's proven that he's 100% healthy? You know, and how much of a hit would he take financially by coming out this year, as opposed to coming back and showing that he is still a top five pick talent? And it may be that by the time we get to mid-January, when he's got to pull the trigger, that he's already shown he's made enough progress that will put everybody's mind at ease. But it's a difficult decision. I mean, it is a business decision, Kevin, and he, I presume, unless he pulls a Peyton Manning or an Andrew Luck and just wants to come back for a fourth season because he likes college, which I guess is possible, then he's got to, he's got to look at this as a dollars and cents decision.
And his family will play a role. I know the presence of his parents, they play a major role, and that's a good thing in a sense that they are completely in tuned in Tua's decision making. This is not a kid who is selfish. He is a kid that makes a decision through the whole family discussing it. And
yes,
when you look at what he's going to decide, let's look at right now what's in front of this Bama football team. And Mac Jones comes in here, and Bama's a program where, listen, they're not going to get, like, you know, guys off the street to play quarterback. They've established a reputation here where they're getting, you know, 4 or 5-star kids to come to this program to play quarterback now because of the offense that we've seen the last couple of years. What is the gap or the type of drop off you would think between Tua and Mac Jones here moving forward in the next couple of weeks?
Well, I think it's, I mean, I you're talking about one of the best quarterbacks in college football, as opposed to a guy that started one game and will have started two games by the time he goes to the Iron Bowl, where he will be on the road before an extremely hostile crowd playing against a defensive coordinator that eats young quarterbacks for breakfast, you know, against a very good defense. I mean, if Mac Jones has it in him, then we're going to find out very quickly. And, you know, all that's at stake is the season for Alabama football. No big deal. So, you know, Mac has been, at the very least competent, and when we've seen him, but nothing had, you know, what did he start? Did he start Arkansas? You know, I believe he started the Arkansas game and played well, against a bad team. He played the second half of the Tennessee game and didn't play all that well. He played okay. So we'll find out soon enough about Mac Jones, but he's got a really high bar to get over in the next 10 days.
And he was, of course, elevated in that Arkansas game. He had three touchdowns. He was, of course, elevated because of the situation where Jalen Hurts transfers. And obviously, yes. Bama fans are sitting there watching, you know, the whole afternoon where they just saw their quarterback, you know, be taken off the off the field and has to go in a cart. And now their biggest fears, you know, are realized where he's done for the season. And then they watch the primetime game on ABC and they see that Jalen Hurts pulls off one of the biggest comebacks that we've seen this season. And a lot of that is they put themselves in that position, Oklahoma in the first half, but I was just blown away by the maturity, the intestinal fortitude of this young man who's been through a lot, yet he never wavered. A couple of mistakes where he's fumbling on the half-yard line, and yes. yet he just does not change his demeanor on the sidelines the entire time, and that is Jalen Hurts and what he did in Waco on Saturday night. What did you see? And as Bama fans were experiencing, like, what could have been? Okay, he would still be our quarterback right now.
Well, he gives us our money's worth. There's no question about that, Kevin. You know, they were in a hole that he did a lot of the digging for, you know, three turnovers. But as you say, he just bowed his neck and refused to allow the team to go down. And it was a remarkable show of steel on the field. So Jalen has kept Oklahoma relevant. He's kept himself relevant in the Heisman race. You know, his numbers are ridiculous. You know, the only negative you can say about him is that he's been a little turnover prone, the last month. But he continues thrown for 3,000 yards. I think he's rushed for 1,000, or he's very close to those numbers. So it's an incredible season, and now we see the. A popular bowl projection is that Oklahoma will play Alabama in the Sugar Bowl. And, you know, there aren't enough seats in the stadium for that. There aren't enough hotel rooms in New Orleans for that. I mean, that's, we've seen the Alabamas of the world when they don't make the playoff, they kind of sleepwalk through the bowl games. You know, we've seen it. It's not just Alabama. Alabama's done it a couple of times. But I would have to believe that if they're playing against Jalen, they will be fired up.
How amazing would that be? Unfortunately, we won't see Tua on the other side. But if that were to happen, obviously, I the two things I would request are an ISO camera on Jalen and an ISO camera on Saban the entire game. Just put it in a box at the corner of the screen, ISO box on Saban every time Jalen's on the field, right? Like, just sure. to get his reaction. And you mentioned, you know, his rushing numbers, 983 yards on the ground. That's the same amount as CeeDee Lamb's receiving yards. Just to give you an idea of what Jalen Hurts has done this season. And back to his demeanor, I joked around in the beginning of the season, and every time we do a highlight, I just call it the revenge tour, the strictly business tour of Jalen Hurts, because just the way he carries himself, right? That we saw some emotion at the end of the game where he hugged Lincoln Riley, and that was great. I'm just so impressed where he's never moved by anything emotionally. At least he never shows it, and the team
never
can feed
it.
Off of that, right? Like the feed that you felt like Oklahoma fed off of that in the second half, where it was like, there's no need to panic. Our quarterback never panics.
Coaches who have worked with him have called him an old soul. And he is a guy who thinks before he speaks and thinks before he acts. And I think we saw a lot of that in the second half, you know, as they scored and took the lead. You didn't see him emote on the bench. He was just looking at, you know, he was just watching. And that's, you know, that's part personality. That's part mental discipline. But it's highly unusual for a young man his age.
Well, he did have his Heisman moment in Waco. We'll see if he'll get that another opportunity to face Baylor down the road in the conference championship game. Still got to handle their business moving forward. And of course, the Bedlam game, which will provide a ton of offense and conversation. Ivan, always great to have you with us here on the podcast.
Thanks, Kevin.
We appreciate Reese, Heather, and Ivan for joining us here on the podcast this Wednesday. Also want to thank our sponsors, Allstate, AT&T, Dr. Pepper, and Goodyear. Check out our brand new podcast, ESPN Daily, hosted by Mina Kimes. That's Monday through Friday. Today, Mina is joined by Jeff Passan to discuss the Astros spying scandal. I already listened to it this morning. It's great. Salacious stuff being covered over on ESPN Daily. Listen and subscribe now to ESPN Daily wherever you find your podcasts. Excellent work from our producer, Taylor Schwenk, on the other side. If you enjoy this podcast and you want more, all you have to do is subscribe to the College Football Podcast with Herbie and Pollock. And, of course, remember to subscribe, rate, and review wherever you get your podcasts. By the way, if you have a question, want to hear it on the podcast for Pollock or Herbie, tweet using the hashtag CFBPod. The best ones will make the podcast. And we will have Pollock join us on Friday. We'll get his thoughts, of course, of the latest rankings, maybe his response to RD, and of course his picks. Cannot wait for it. Looking forward to it. Thank you.